Good afternoon. Montreal 6-0. Get that out of the way right off the bat. Hello, everybody. My name is Cameron Charlebois. I'm the chair of the board of the Blue Metropolis Foundation. Welcome to the Walrus Talks at the Blue Metropolis International Literary Festival for the second year. I'm going to say a few words about Blue Metropolis and then pass over to Shelley, who will talk about the rest. Blue Metropolis is a literary foundation, best known for this festival. Our tagline is, as you see, the power of words. We work, we focus, we endeavor to bring forward the notions of reading, writing, and talking that all combine together for thinking. And we think, we believe, we endeavor to use thinking as a way to build a better society and a better Canada. This festival is going great guns. There's a lot happening today. A lot has happened. There's a lot happening today at 4 o'clock this afternoon. I'll do a few pitches here. We have Michael Enright interviewing our grand prize laureate, who's Richard Ford. I've met Richard. This is an exciting author, and I'm sure it's going to be a spectacular interview. Followed by Eleanor Wachtel, who will be interviewing our Prix Azur winner, Luis Alberto Urrea, and that'll be at 6 o'clock this evening. There's something this evening with Slate Magazine. Is it sold out, William or Greg? There's 4 tickets left for that this evening on the plateau. There is tomorrow another Slate Magazine event, and then the festival wraps up with an homage to Alice Munro that will be happening at the hotel, the festival, with a cocktail to end the day. Blue Metropolis also has programs. And these programs focus an awful lot on social issues, and one of our main streams is mental health, bullying, and marginalization. We've published a book as part of this festival called Before and After. I think you can pick up copies of it that look at marginalized women and have worked with them through images and poetry writing for them to get their story out. And I think it's this area of programs that brings us in contact with the Walrus Talks of today, which focuses on states of mind. And I know that some of the speakers are going to be, because I listened to the radio this morning and I heard 2 of them on the radio, are going to be speaking about states of mind in the sense of depression, mental illness, and so on. And I think that that becomes a very close intimacy with what Blue Metropolis stands for. So Blue Metropolis and Walrus are lovers. We have a tremendous friendship going here. The likeness of mind in terms of what we're trying to do and keying off of a lot of the discourse of Walrus to build a better Canada, to use thinking and writing and interaction to build a better Canada. And I believe that that's what we are about as well. And so it's a real pleasure to be part of this afternoon and to have Walrus Talks as part of the festival. So with that, I would like to invite Shelley Ambrose, who is the executive director, the co-publisher of the Walrus Foundation and co-publisher of the Walrus Magazine, to come and carry it from here. Shelley.
I do love Cameron Charlebois. It was his idea that we come, don't touch the microphone. And what did I do? These Walrus Talks, I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. I want to thank Cameron and Blue Met for having us. This is our second time to have the Walrus Talks at Blue Metropolis, our second time here at the beautiful McCord Museum. I want to thank Suzanne Sauvage and everybody at the McCord for hosting us. I also want to thank our sponsor. We usually have folks from Enbridge with us, but they are not here today. So I want to give a big shout out to our sponsor and partner at Enbridge. They're a keen supporter of all things Walrus all across the country. And Cameron, aren't you doing the Enbridge ride in a couple of weeks?
Yes.
Are you fundraising for that? Am I doing you a favor right now? Okay, if anyone would like to support Cameron Charlebois in his Enbridge ride, I support him so I don't have to do it. It's easier if I pay and he does it. But anyway, that congratulations on that. So we are at the Walrus are very grateful to Enbridge for their participation, their presence. There's no way we could be in Montreal and bring all these wonderful people in without their support. For those of you who know Blue Mat but aren't really sure what a walrus is, I will tell you that a walrus is a very large, smelly marine animal that lives in the Arctic. It's also a magazine called The Walrus. And The Walrus is published by a charitable nonprofit foundation, and this is really pointy-headed, educational mandate to create forums for debate on matters vital to Canadians. We do that in the magazine, but we also do it in rooms and on stages like this from coast to coast to coast. We, in the magazine at walrus.ca, in our ebooks on Walrus TV, you will find conversations on everything from foreign affairs, technology, art, sports, the environment, business, culture, fiction, poetry. We've got it all going on. We celebrated our 10th anniversary last year, which is, to us, slightly miraculous. The Walrus, we have no owner. We are an independent creature. We have no wings and no one point of view. The Walrus Talks were born about 6 years ago. In this year, in 2014, we are doing the Walrus Talks Conversation, the Walrus Talks the Future, the Walrus Talks Water, the Walrus Talks Human Rights, Energy, Philanthropy, Climate, and as Cameron knows, we're doing the Walrus Talks Resilience as it pertains to cities in Toronto at the Art Gallery in October, which was your idea. Those events are in Vancouver, Calgary, Toronto, Ottawa, Sackville, St. John's. We're just one big happy road tour. We're going everywhere. So if you're somewhere else other than Montreal, check the website and see if you're somewhere that we are, and we'd be happy to see you anywhere that we are. This afternoon's event, Enbridge Presents the Walrus Talk State of Mind, is being live-streamed at thewalrus.ca and will be, after this, available for viewing on Walrus TV. The Twitter hashtag, if you're so inclined, is Walrus Talks. Okay, two more things to tell you, and then I really promise to get on with it. One is we have launched a campaign for our 10th anniversary called the Walrus Campaign for Optimistic Canadians, and that is a campaign that enables our donors, of which we are grateful, we have many, to make five-year commitments to the Walrus, whether it's $10 a year for 5 years or $1 million a year for 5 years. What we're looking for is the kind of transformational change that the Walrus can know that the people that are on board for the next 5 years leading up to our birthday, Canada's birthday in 2017. Our founding donor, Chalkers, is a Montreal family foundation. They've been supporting us for 10 years, so we're asking people to come on board with us for the next 5 years. And if you don't want to write us a check or give us your credit card number, that's okay, because you can also donate Aeroplan miles. Aeroplan and Aimia are a wonderful partner of ours, and they help us to fly writers and photographers places we could not afford to send them, like the Arctic, and they also help us with our Walrus Talks participants to come in. They match mile for mile what you donate. So up to 1 million Aeroplan miles, and that's a lot of flights. So that would be great. You can do that at thewalrus.ca/Canada-Day. Now, here is how the Walrus Talks works. Each of our esteemed speakers has exactly 7 minutes, and they know this. Each one will come on stage and introduce themselves. There is no MC. Each talk will act as a standalone. You can follow along on your program. They are coming in the order as advertised, and their bios are on the back. We truly believe that you can follow along and don't need me to read it all out loud to you, so I am not going to do that. You will hear them 8 in a row, and our hope is that an hour from now we'll all have a lot to think about and talk about in the conversation, and have a conversation in the post-talks reception, which is just out there in the atrium. So that is our goal. Our goal is always to have the audience leave thinking, I never thought of it that way before. And I hope that's how you leave here, thinking about states of mind. So just before I disappear, I'd like to thank them all in advance. They've come from all over to be with us here today. Sheila Rogers from Gabriola Island, BC, via Cape Breton. Madeleine Tien from Vancouver. Josef Nabokovic, Montreal, but he was just came from Stockholm, really, home to Montreal. Lisa Moore from St. John's, Newfoundland. Zoe Whittle from Toronto. George Elliott Clark, who's teaching at Harvard this semester, has joined us from Boston. And Alex Olin has come up from California. And Al Ray from a successful, you're at Oxford, that's a big fat lie. But Al has just finished running the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, so he has come from his home in Winnipeg. So thank you to all of you, and let us begin. Hello, I'm Sheila Rogers. My talk is called From the Inside Out, What I Wish I Could Have Said If I'd Had a Voice. Of course, you think I have a voice, even a national voice, but I've completely lost my voice a number of times over the last 3.5 decades and for extended periods of time. Can you imagine my anxiety? Will it come back? What if it doesn't? I actually don't know how to do anything else but talk. In fact, I love a microphone, so much so that a certain magazine publisher, whose initials are Shelley Ambrose, has on occasion called me a microphone slut. I once heard that the soprano Cecilia Bartoli refer to her voice as her pet. I understand that. I have a relationship to my voice that could be characterized as master pet. I feed it, I care for it, and it can do tricks. You have an impression of me hearing my voice. You think I'm warm and sunny. So cheerful. The merry sunshine of CBC Radio, perhaps. Maybe even perky. I hate perky. And you may have wondered, why is she so damn perky? Well, let me go back a little bit. I first encountered the ravaging rat of depression in my late teens. I felt as though I had a hole in the core of my being. I went to the university health clinic to see what was wrong, and I was told it was hormonal. It was PMS. And one tends to believe the people in white coats with stethoscopes around their necks. So for years I thought I had PMS, except it didn't just last a week or 10 days. Sometimes it was 3 weeks or a month. So I had PMS, MS, and post-MS. Most of the time, I could function, still go to work and school, and seem relatively the same. This is called presenteeism, where you are in fact absent, but you still show up and go through the motions. There were also days when I massively overcompensated for feeling low by adopting a sort of perky swagger, which included exuberant reading of scripts and a lot of laughing. Often, I laughed too long, too hard, and too quickly. Inside, though, I would be roiling with self-doubt, self-hatred, and an endless emptiness as big as the Gobi Desert, and there seemed to be no way out. I managed this for decades until the big one came in January of 2003. I had a very high blood pressure reading, and I fainted one day. I went to see my doctor, and she said, "You won't go back to work until the reading is normal." When I was off the conveyor belt of work, when I didn't have a role or a national microphone, I didn't know who I was. I lost myself. I felt I had nothing to get dressed up for. I had feelings of doubt, pessimism, guilt, hopelessness, helplessness, worthlessness, irritability. Personally and professionally, I felt devalued. I had a great sense of incompetence and a great ingratitude toward those around me, my close circle. And I had, not for the first time, thoughts of suicide. I was finally diagnosed with depression, and now I know that when I'm sick, my brain ceases to function in a number of ways. Normally, I'm very verbal, you kind of have to be on the radio. And on good days, I'm even articulate. I'm an avid reader. You kind of have to be when you host a book show. And most of the time, I'm quite outgoing. But when the illness takes hold, I'm no longer able to understand what I'm reading. My verbal skills become really jumbled at best, and at worst, almost non-existent. I think the big one from 2003 had been coming for some time. For years, it was like a train that I kept on missing. But then I got off the treadmill of work, and it stole in like a thief. I was pinned down by a deep lethargy, and at one point, here it comes, I couldn't talk. I couldn't find my voice. I could only squawk. For 3 weeks, this chickeny thing was coming out of my mouth. Funny how it hits you where you live. And when I had no voice, people asked me questions, and here's what I wish I could have said, even though I had no voice. When people said, "Get over it," I wish I could have said, "Oh, thanks." It never occurred to me that I just needed to adjust my attitude. When people said, "Happiness is a choice," I wish I could have said, "So you think I'm choosing to be this way?" When people said, "You're being self-indulgent," I wish I'd told them to F off. When my husband asked, "What should I tell people?" I wanted to say, "Tell them I just can't get out of bed. Tell them I find the ceiling endlessly fascinating. I can't talk. Call work. Make something up. Tell them I have the flu, strep throat, pink eye." People really hate pink eye. When kind, loving people asked, "What can I do?" I would love to have said this or have heard this. "Let me know that you're there. Even if you think I don't care, if this continues, let me know that you're still there." And this is what families, friends, and colleagues can do. They can comfort, create a safe place, care, help with diagnosis, come forward with family history. That was a big one for me. Since I was diagnosed, I've learned that there's been depression in my family for quite a long time. Families and friends can help with confidentiality, help you take your medication, watch for triggers, answer phones and doorbells, advocate with employers and the system is a whole other walrus talk. I'm public about this because I want people to understand that this is an illness, and like most illnesses, it sucks. I want to use my fully functioning voice to say that depression is an illness. It is not a character flaw or a moral failure. I've been thinking a lot about my friend, the great writer Alistair MacLeod, who died on Easter Sunday. My husband and I would visit him every summer in Cape Breton, and around 11 o'clock in the morning, he would say, "Would something in a glass make the day a little easier?" He also talked about how we make assumptions about people, and he wrote about the awfulness of oversimplification. To close, I just want to say this. People with supportive families, friends, and colleagues who know and understand that depression is an illness, those people recover faster and function just like you in this big, beautiful world. It's what Alistair MacLeod said in his novel, No Great Mischief. All of us are better when we're loved. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to be here. I've been away from Montreal for the last 8 months, and I thought for homecoming I wanted to do something a bit more of an experiment, so I've tried to evoke landscapes of mind and state of mind through both the visual and the textual and the spoken. Dear S, it has been nearly a year since our last correspondence. In case you're wondering, I have been well. There are some things I never had the chance to say, and I hope that I can find the guts to say them now in about 7 minutes. Let me digress by telling you a true story. Once there was a man who suffered from severe nerve damage. The smallest touch, even a breeze through a window, caused him unbearable anguish. The pain was so acute that he was determined to kill himself. In a last act of desperation, his neurosurgeon lesioned part of his brain. That is, they burned away a web of cells. After surgery, the man appeared calm. "So the pain has gone," his doctors asked. "Gone," the man said. "Oh, no. The pain is exactly the same." "What in the world do you mean? How could it be exactly the same?" The man said, "No, it's true. The pain is exactly the same as it was, but it feels as if it is not being done to me. I really don't feel it so much." The neurologist concluded that pain and suffering might not be exactly the same thing. One can be cleaved from the other, like a diamond split along its fractures, so that there is pain, but it is not yours, and so you do not suffer so much. Let me tell you another story. Out of the blue, 6 years ago, you contacted me. We had barely corresponded before. You wanted a place in Montreal to finish writing your novel. You wanted my apartment. You were an exciting, brash young woman, a successful young novelist, and I wanted to help. I never imagined that letting you into my private sphere could bring about such pain. The last time I saw you in person, I was in a room on the sixth floor of an art gallery in Toronto. You came into the room with a big smile on your face. The room was empty except for me. You veered in my direction, still smiling. I couldn't move. You smashed into me. It was as if I was a piece of furniture, a misplaced chair, an invisible step. But no, not quite. I suddenly saw myself as you did, a 35-year-old Chinese-Canadian woman, an object of contempt. Does a chair ever feel a person's contempt? You were with your friend M, and you both began laughing theatrically, laughing so hard at me, at the shock on my face, you actually had to hold one another upright. And then you were both gone. Since that time, I've been thinking a great deal about the possibility and the pain of personhood. I have a theory that might interest you. I believe that personhood is a quality of human dignity that we give to each other. S, you probably do not know this, but the word munt was used by whites in South Africa and former Rhodesia as a derogatory term against blacks, particularly black men. The startling thing is that the word munt is derived from an Ndebele word, omuntu. Omuntu means human being or person. It is related to the philosophical ideal of unhu, which is, I am well, but only if you are well too. When I think about personhood, this is where my thoughts go. Not to what kind of person I have the potential to be, but the harder, more devastating question of who is allowed to be a person at all. My experience with mental illness has been exactly this, that the reality of people living in poverty, at the margins, the reality of people whose histories have been denied by our society, whose rights have been trampled, who are looked at with suspicion, who are dismissed in our media and our culture, or used as the scapegoats in our political campaigns, whose countries are bombed and then forgotten, whose genocides are considered minor, they become aware of another reality that is hidden. To see something that the rest of society denies is devastating. It can make you crazy. I have seen it in the lives of people I love and in my own life. Look too hard into the structure of society and the world inside you, the fragile personhood that says we are all equal, will fray. So many people in our society are denied the privilege, the well-being, the grace of personhood. And so many other people take it entirely for granted. I am addressing this letter to you, S, because I want you to know that some things cannot be disavowed. I, a private person, have sent this letter into the public world. It is neither a work of fiction nor a work of nonfiction. It is a state of being, the state of my mind. One last thing before I end this letter. This thought belongs to William Stafford, and it is called Being a Person. Be a person here. Stand by the river, invoke the owls. invoke winter, then spring. Let any season that wants to come here make its own call. After that sound goes away, wait. A slow bubble rises through the earth and begins to include sky, stars, all space, even the outracing, expanding thought. Come back and hear that little sound again. Come back and hear that call. Suddenly, this dream you are having matches everyone's dream, and the result is the world. If a different call came, there wouldn't be any world, or you, or the river, or the owls calling. How you stand here is important. How you listen for the next things to happen. How you breathe. Sincerely, Madeline Tien.
Oops. Okay, so 7 minutes, but there is no chess clock here, right? It's like speed chess. After 7 minutes, the red flag should fall, and then I will know I'm done. I will talk, actually, about red flags and the time before they fell and after, namely communism, Soviet Union, and Yugoslavia. I come from Yugoslavia, Croatia, and anyhow, you know, there we didn't have any problems that the West had. We didn't have allergies, for example. That was an American thing. We didn't have depression, you know. Why be depressed? You live in a perfect society, and if you don't like it, well, we will still lock you up in a psychiatric asylum, of course, because you're maladjusted, and that is an illness. Even in the West, it is an illness to be maladjusted. Anyhow, especially dissidents, you know. Psychiatry in the Soviet Union was partly used to suppress dissidents. So if you wanted to leave the country, you acknowledged that you didn't get along, that you didn't fit, and so therapy was in order. So you would go into a lunatic asylum, and definitely after a while you would be crazy. Actually, a new man in Yugoslavia who was in a lunatic asylum and came out, and the anecdote I knew about him was that Yugoslavia used to be closed. Later, it opened its borders. It opened them up. So when I was a kid, we no longer had this sense of enclosure and you know, division between East and West, and despair to run away. This man was caught when he was trying to leave Yugoslavia, and then he was treated in a mental institution that was probably very sane. And then after that, he was insane. The issue of insanity there, it's a little bit philosophical. You know, many of you have read the R.D. Lang and his anti-psychiatry stuff. If you are in an insane society and you don't fit, Are you really insane, or are you maybe trying to find the right way that other people have already given up on? Maybe you're saner than the ones who simply sail along the ship that is about to sink and it's on the wrong course. Same I would say even in relation to now we have the wars in Yugoslavia and a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now it's called disorder, but I would prefer to call it a syndrome. Things that run together without the judgment of it being disorder. Because obviously war was a huge disorder, so if you suffer from a variety of things after it, I wouldn't say that is necessarily a disorder, but it is a syndrome. You're affected by things. Now, are you insane because you're affected, or are you more insane if you're not affected? I'm actually more worried about people who don't have post-traumatic stress syndrome in former Yugoslavia, who behave as though nothing had happened, and we can just sail along and be happy, be a little desensitized. Of course, technically speaking,
that is part of the stress syndrome, to be desensitized to events and actually not even to feel much. I visited a friend of mine. He's a Serbian exile from my hometown in Croatia. He lives in Belgrade, and he was sitting around, and he had two beautiful granddaughters and the little fish pond, and lots of doves. He raises doves, and he looked very grumpy, and he said, I know, I should be happy. Look at these beautiful children, you know, but I feel nothing. So I feel nothing. And I said, wow. Then I asked him about his brother who killed himself, and their mother who also killed herself. And I said, well, you know, when she killed herself, that was a very traumatic event. I said, no, not as much as you think. He kind of shocked me that way. Because, well, I think that is part of the disorder, that you can be desensitized. So what to do? Who knows what to do? But at any rate, now when I go back to the former Yugoslavia, at least people acknowledge that we have depression. Before they didn't, you know. Nobody was depressed, except we had the high rate of suicide. Because we had untreated depression. Hungary was the highest. We were in the top as well. I remember when I got to the States, I was really surprised because everybody smiled. And I thought, what's wrong with these people? Because a friend of mine, when he went from Croatia to Banja Luka, once smiled at a stranger, and a stranger broke his nose because he thought that smile was some kind of challenge and ridicule. Because people there were not used to smiling. And so I remember I got to the States and I was in the college, and every morning a beautiful black woman would tell me, you'll be all right. And I said, why is she telling me that? But she explained that I really looked grumpy all the time. So she said, whatever it was, it will go away and I will eventually be okay. I guess I will become, and I did become Americanized. What I didn't know at that time was that Americans were depressed and they acknowledged it and they treated it. And so they were all stoned, you know. We of course try that too. We were all pretty much drunk, but that's different. You get more depressed after it. So now recently, what I want to say about this post-traumatic stress syndrome in post-communist societies, you know, I like post, but let me say that there is a pre as well, and I would like to call it pre-traumatic stress syndrome. In Yugoslavia and so on, because things were falling apart, Tito died, and there was a great deal of tension. People were really anxious, and you could see things were not leading anywhere good. And it's happening again. I went to Bosnia, they burned down the part of the parliament and the presidential palace, and so on, and they have no hope, because they don't have any jobs. Many of them with the post-traumatic stress syndrome actually can't even work. They're so rattled, they cannot concentrate. I know actually a man in Montreal who walks around all the time, and I finally said, well, why do you walk so much? That's really healthy, and you look good. And I said, yeah, I have the walking syndrome. So what do you mean walking syndrome? I said, well, you know, I was in Sarajevo, I was trapped, they bombed. He used to be an opera singer, and then he said that after that, after he can't work, he can't concentrate. The only thing he can do is walk, which is kind of a good solution, but he walks like 10, 12 hours a day. So I ran into him all over the city. He seems to be all right. He's not depressed. I think walking is really the best therapy for everything. In fact, in England now, you will not get prescription for antidepressants unless you prove that you walk half an hour a day. And only then, you know, if you keep everything running, maybe your mind will be uplifted as well. So that is a good point there. Where's the red flag? Is it falling? So, but just to illustrate again, in Bosnia, I asked people, well, what is this protest about? I know the government is terrible and you want it down, but the next one, of course, also will be terrible. And you know that? He said, yeah, we know that. And But it's just an expression of total discontent. And the man said, you know, this is about the Bosnian soul. It's not the details. So we just came here to express ourselves and basically to express the communal depression, communal post-traumatic and pre-traumatic stress syndrome, because obviously things are going in the wrong direction again. Okay, with those uplifting words.
Hello, everyone. I'm Lisa Moore. I'm going to talk about suspension of disbelief and also rereading Jean Rhys 30 years later. I'm going to talk about that subtly altered state of mind that occurs when we read fiction. It's a kind of active dreaming that we commonly call the suspension of disbelief. The phrase was coined by the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and it describes a voluntary cognitive estrangement from the facts. And Coleridge believed that it would bring about a kind of poetic faith. So why would we suspend everything we know to be true? Why would we willingly give up the concrete and knowable world for the world in a novel? And how do we do it? What kind of mechanism allows for this grand transformation? I want to tell you about my own rereading of Jean Rhys's novel, The Wide Sargasso Sea. It's a story set in the mid-19th century on a Caribbean island about a young Creole woman who marries a British colonizer and returns to England with him only to wither from the grief of homesickness, become insane, and ultimately her husband's prisoner, locked away in his attic. The novel was Jean Rhys's response to Charlotte Bronte's novel, Jane Eyre. Rhys felt that the Creole madwoman in Rochester's attic hadn't been given a voice. So she wrote the woman a backstory, giving her thoughts and feelings and passions, a vividly felt childhood, showing her life on a tropical island after slavery, and even giving her a name, Antoinette. A few weeks ago, I was on my way for a trip to Dominica, the Caribbean island that was Jean Rhys's childhood, where she grew up until she was the age of 16. I had happened upon a new edition of the novel while I was stuck in Toronto overnight because I'd missed my connecting flight due to an ice storm. I began reading the novel again 30 years after my first encounter with the book at a restaurant near a hotel airport in Mississauga. I had walked in a cold wind with a $32 voucher from the airline for Boston Pizza, next to an 8-lane highway past several box stores, one with a parking lot sign that promised half-priced adult videotapes, and in the same parking lot, a class of 7-year-olds dressed in white karate suits with black belts, and they all had aluminum cutlasses and were standing very still and then suddenly lunging forward in unison and crashing invisible assailants with their swords. What a shock it was to fall headlong into the wild Sargasso Sea again, to give over completely, to be swallowed whole, so that Boston Pizza and Mississauga and the 8-lane highway and the fierce wind and the brave young ninjas all just fell completely away. I had decided while reading to try and make the novel a test case so that I could figure out at what moment the words before my eyes fell away and I was no longer aware of the act of reading, no longer aware of myself or my surroundings, but became, rather, an egoless, amorphous consciousness, not exactly hovering over the action, but feeling it plow through me, creating it, being it. I was looking for that moment when I had wholly suspended disbelief. But instead of noticing the how of it, or the when of it, I was watching a burning parrot. An angry mob of recently freed slaves in Dominica were burning a plantation house to the ground. The parrot, which had been a pet parrot and had had its wings clipped, had made it to the roof of the plantation house, and as all the crowd turned to look up into the smoke-blackened night sky, the bird caught fire and fell to the ground in a ball of flames. I was 20 years old when I first read The Wide Sargasso Sea. I both remembered and did not remember the parrot. I found it to be an unexpected, shocking image, but also deeply familiar, a part of me, something that had been a part of me since I was 20 and had studied Reese's novel in what was then called a Commonwealth literature course and would now probably be called a postcolonial course. The next morning, I was on a veranda of a guest house looking out at the tropical jungle at sunrise. The sun made the wet, dark tangle of forest turn brilliant lime, as if the whole jungle were on a dimmer switch and someone had turned it to the highest setting. I could smell the dusty lime leaves and hibiscus and cinnamon bark, just as Reese had described it. It is the engagement of the senses that provokes the suspension of disbelief while reading a novel, being able to see and touch and smell and hear that fictive world, and it's perhaps the sense of smell that does it most powerfully. The phrase suspension of disbelief kind of requires a double take. It seems like a sleight of hand to lure you away from everything you hold to be true. Why not just say, more simply, believe? But the word suspense seems to hold the promise of a return. There's the idea of a limited duration in the word suspension. It's just a brief passage of time. And yet we are emerged, and yet we emerge from the experience changed. There's the idea of a homecoming. Aristotle believed that a theater audience must suspend disbelief in order to experience catharsis, or in other words, release tensions to purify the soul. I believe that the suspension of disbelief has another radical purpose. I believe we suspend disbelief to experience intense and unmitigated pleasure, the pleasure of exercising that vestigial organ, the imagination. The imagination allows us to invent possibility and therefore hope. Reese endeavors to give the specter of the lunatic that haunts Bronte's novel a colonial history. The theorist Frantz Fanon, in his book The Wretched of the Earth, talks about his experience of coming from the Caribbean to study psychiatry in Paris and being sent to Algeria, where there was reportedly a very high instances of insanity. Fanon found that his patients were not insane, but only exhibiting the symptoms of any healthy victim of colonialism. At the end of Charlotte Bronte's novel, Jane Eyre, and at the end of Jean Rhys's novel, The Wide Sargasso Sea, a woman driven mad by the ravages of colonialism sets fire to a British estate built on the spoils of empire. I finished Rhys's novel for the second time in the back seat of a rental car while we had stopped to purchase some fruit from a roadside vendor. The moist, fragrant jungle pressed in on all sides. The sun was setting over Scott's head, a dark, boiling red sky and a blood-red sea. Because the sunset was so fierce and the lights in the back seat quickly dimming, I could hardly see the print. My tired eyes saw each letter on the page backlit by an afterimage, the glowing of the fierce red setting sun, and each letter had the appearance of being on fire. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Zoe Woodall, and I'm really happy to be back in my home province today. I'm going to be talking about longing as it relates to being a reader and a writer. I recall the moment I saw the first editions of my debut book in a cardboard box fresh from the printers on the front porch of my publisher's house. I expected it to be the highlight of my then 25 years on the planet, but instead I felt a hollowness, lifting my shoulders in a shrug, smoothing my palms along the front covers. I lugged the box to the back of a waiting cab, as though it were filled with groceries, and I looked out the window at Toronto, my newly adopted city, as it rolled by, waiting for a feeling that never came. So this is what it is to arrive at a goal, an almost neutral feeling. The most transcendent moment of my new life as a writer was the day I signed my first publishing contract, the promise of something to come. I have published 8 books since then, and each time the contract signing day, or the day I meet with my editor for first draft notes, or the day they show me the cover mock-ups, I'm filled with a sparkling pleasure of anticipation. It has an ISBN number. It has a back cover copy. When the moment the finished book comes in, it is almost already gone. It is not unlike the joy of having a crush and the dance involved before it is realized, if it ever is. The waiting is the most agonizing and the most perfect part. The longing for a feeling, the promise of future joy, eclipses the actual feeling. But a writer is one who takes up longing as a profession. The poet Tony Hoagland said that every poet has an irresolvable obsession that serves their whole career. And I think that's true of every writer. There's an emotional question that can't ever be answered, and that's what drives their best work. It is pounded out and worked over in both successful and failed books until the end of our careers. No matter what happens to the characters in an A.M. Holmes novel, for example, the books are all about adoption and abandonment, and every Miriam Taves novel is about the ramifications of religious childhood, every Mary Carr memoir is about drinking or God, and our books are undeniably about our failures or a failure to understand a certain state of mind, a quest to answer a lifelong uncertainty. I spent the last 5 years writing a book about a family nothing like my own, in a place I've never lived, going through something I've never gone through. I've been living inside the head of a 50-year-old woman abandoned by her husband, parenting a 16-year-old kid through tragedy. And with this new book, I took on all sorts of creative challenges, third-person omniscience, taking on that most masculine of terrain, realism, engaging with emotional facts so foreign to me that writing every word and sentence took 40 times as long as it normally did. And in the end, I nearly failed. But I signed the contracts last week, and it will exist, and it almost let me down to realize that no matter how hard I tried to do otherwise, I'd once again written a book about anxiety and longing, moving fast along life's road in anticipation of a perfect feeling. I could write a book narrated by a pony in a satellite circling the Earth, and it would be about this state. There is no avoiding it. I've spent the majority of the last 8 weeks in a room with 7 other writers collaboratively writing a season of television for the show Degrassi. Every day we ask, what is the emotional narrative? What do they want? We give them a goal, and at first they fail, and then they succeed. It is tidy. It is an ordered process as we fill every whiteboard wall around us with episodic trajectories. The actors' headshots are pinned above the boards, and a table is filled with coffee cups and markers and paper drafts. We tell each other stories of our teen years so that the stories become real. And it feels as though we are volleying a clump of unraveling yarn engulfed in fire back and forth, trying to contain it, and then we roll it all into an orderly ball before we offer it up for network notes. It is intensely satisfying to break a story and then watch through the monitors as the actors bring the story to life. And at the end of 22 minutes, the characters have changed and we start again. What else can we put these made-up people through, and what can they long for? Novels are a messier medium, movable, always moving, even as the final draft is cemented and typeset and finite. In the end, it is only through our active participation as a reader, collaborating with the author to have an experience of the story that is only their own, that the emotional journey of the author and the characters and the reader is complete. Viewers of television are passive, even as we may throw popcorn at the screen in frustration as an episode of Scandal goes bananas, but that passivity is its appeal. Literature shouldn't quiet us. We should be longing along with that authorial voice, that narrator's voice, as it longs to find answers that don't exist. The anxiety sustains us and urges us to keep going and keep reading, because that journey and that longing is the whole point.
George Eliot Clark is the Tracer, Tracy, Montreal Encore. I'm talking about history, map or trap. My title allows an antithesis. History can be a map, a series of triumphs or defeats, victories or crises that structure the consciousness of an individual or a people. It may even have a teleological drive from Eden to Zion, or from Bartolomé de las Casas, the proponent of the transatlantic slave trade, to U.S. President Barack Obama, who may be viewed as a messiah figure redeeming the history of African servitude in the New World. How one maps a history determines one's sense of progress or regress, deliverance or damnation. Yet history can also act as a trap, a quagmire, so that one lives as a zombie, repeating the same actions with the same consequences. This notion is indebted partly to Marxism, the idea that the oppressed are stuck in history, and only revolution may deliver or liberate them. The most intransigent disputes, the Middle East, or for that matter, the plight of First Nations in Canada, show signs of folks being entrapped in history with no map out. I'm thinking much of history as I write my epic poem, Canticles, which deals with the image of the Negro in Western civilization as well as the transatlantic slave trade. Pound says the epic is a poem containing history. In my work, perhaps history is a trap of oppression against which various actors compose a map. Three such actors are Nat Turner, leader of slave revolt in Virginia in 1831, and also Hannibal, who came close to conquering Rome in 218 to 201 BCE. Also St. Augustine of Hippo, authoring his doctrine of just war in 1470. So these are dramatic monologues, exploring states of consciousness, states of mind. Nat Turner. At the dusk of daybreak, the Atlantic slaps rocks till they cry and sob awake. And the squawks made by some of those slaps as the rocks react is like the slap of gulls treading water or touching beach to grab a morsel of flesh to break open shelled flesh. And here is the meaning of daybreak, to be slapped awake. A breakage always, shock and slap of it like a whip of surf breaking against rock. The whip of bull cock smacking and breaking against skin, leaving a bloody wake. So even an old black woman must squawk, moan, piss herself, the break of air snapping as she hollers, a whip breaking blood, making blood cross her back. So her scream surf air in the wake, squawking, the whip breaking against my mama's back, leaking blood in the wake. What black flesh is for, the breaking of soil, the smashing of rock. And the whip surfs the air before it breaks bad against my mama's back. My child's back too, black back too. So kitties squawk as their blood surfs upon the air, as the whip breaks skin so sharp as a knife. And it is blood in my eyes, and it is blood in my piss, and it is blood in my lungs, and it is blood in my sperm, and the water that reels from my eyes, and the water that peels from my skin, all is blood, a steady pulse and punctuation of it, and a plantation of blood. The white cotton goes crimson, sodden with it. The crop of thorns springs up from blood. The Atlantic is a red sea. Virginia's beaches are a red tide. The apple brandy is blood mixed. The red letter words in sermons bleed. I look at the moon, there is blood. I look at corn, there is blood. There's a message in all this bleeding. I hear a word spoken in blood to answer the snapping whip. I must use an unbreaking sword. Hannibal. We will bring proud Rome to book and end her bullying and hectoring and prove to her the pain of tussling with Moorish eminence. We find her soldiers be so much butchered meat. Unbroken, unbridled, we swarm the Alps to have to brave winter worries, the snowy subterfuges that plunge us into crevasse or abyss. Elephants tumbling down as out of place as turtles in a desert, their trunks snaking out the snort air but never snatch a hold. History is hell. We meet our fleeing foe. A hammer blow crushes one skull. So blood is free, mixing with falling snow. An axe blow pitches another head free of its nick. The blonde hair splashes the snow as incidental amber. Our triumphs drench our heads in wine, but drown the Roman skulls in blood. Victors know a heady drenching. The ruddy body snow blanched seem a paste of grapes or strawberries and appetizing sludge. So thorough is our murdering, it is massacre. And we see how blood displaces dew at dawn, how green grass gleams coppery, how blood cascades smooth as a mountain stream. Triumph after triumph, we thunder toward Rome. Abundant horses, big-ass elephants, ponderous, all thundering down the Alps toward Rome. The tender earth accepting our cleaving steps as we rush downward like bee-sting stampeded bulls to fall upon the Romans as presumptuous as gods. We strike them as intolerable waves, loathsome torrents, as vultures' raucous wings slap the air and the headstrong Romans flounder as if drowning like lemmings as we thrust them over cliffs or thrust our spears through them. St. Augustine, justifying war. Policy requires a gathering of palookas, a storehouse of heroes cemented by blood and belief, skilled at battle, axe, and sail, all manner of hand-to-hand bloodshed, to roam the roan and rhyme upon the rhyme, chop up the sea into waves, and God's enemies into sausage, the tumult of blood, naked pampered putrefaction, the overhanging arrows whistling instantly downward to bluntly thud heathens' hearts or heads, so that they suddenly find themselves alive, burning in the sulfur stench of hell, guarantees us our justice. If it comes to pass that an accursed cur, some whoreson pup finds our soldier's spear stuck in his chest, so his jaws strain to grab at air any morsel of oxygen, but only blood bubbles from his mouth, so be it. It is his damnation, for having charged at our fluttering spears, the uplifted wave crest, brazen flood of the tips, descending to perforate the flesh of horses, and smash the opposing forces, questionable men, to pieces skewered. I cannot imagine any philosophy that would spare God's opponents relentless pain. The city of God offers Antichrist hordes, devouring steel and fire, hungry faggots, torches, famished arrows, bristling spears, blitzing the sky. So our suburbs are ranks of noxious corpses, raw meat, maggoty for jagged-mouthed dogs. Interminable black smoke covers and chokes the last breath of the dying. We witness convolutions of black smoldering clouds. We see our foes destroyed to the bone, and that's the bone burned to ash. This is justice. That venal foreignness, outside baptism, discover in the flesh beautiful wounds, beautified by insects, even with the hooked fish eyes, rotting, you see.
Hi, I'm Alex Olean. And a few months ago, I received a handwritten letter in the mail from a reader. And I was thrilled, of course, as I always am when I hear from readers. I sometimes get emails or Facebook messages, but to have actually moved someone so much that they took the time to sit down and write me a letter by hand, that felt like a real accomplishment. So I was very excited, and I opened it up, and I found words to this effect. Dear Miss Olean, I recently read your novel Inside, and I'd like to know, why is your book so depressing? The letter writer went on to list all the unhappy things contained in my novel. Mental illness, divorce, suicide, genocide, sexual assault, etc. I swear it's not as bleak as it sounds. But the letter writer, who was a sweet person, seemed less distraught over the existence of these things in the world than concerned for my own mental health. I hope you are aware, the letter concluded, that there are happy things in life. Perhaps you should write about those someday. I was flustered by the letter, although probably I shouldn't have been, because to be honest, it's not the first time I've received this kind of reaction. At the end of one of my first major interviews with a magazine, the reporter closed her notebook and said, "You know, it's funny, your characters are so unhappy, but you seem like such a happy person." And then there was the time that I visited book club with my first book, and I asked what questions people had, and a woman put up her hand and said, "Your main character, she's so sad and so brittle. I didn't like that." That was her whole question. So at this point, you're probably wondering why I keep writing at all, inflicting these stories on people and getting these kind of responses back. And there's something about these comments that seems to imply that it's somehow unseemly to write about unhappy topics or unhappy people. It's as though people keep saying to me, what's a nice girl like you doing in a dark place like this? Now, I do take some comfort in the fact that I know that as a writer, I'm not alone in having received these kinds of reactions. I was recently reading about the deluge of letters received by the New Yorker magazine after they published Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, which is about a ritual stoning in a small New England town. The magazine was flooded by letters from people who wanted to cancel their subscriptions, although a few people, it must be said, just wanted to know whether such ritual stonings were actually occurring and where they could go to watch them. But the more typical response came from a woman who wrote, I read this story while soaking in the tub, and by the time I got to the end, I wanted to put my head underwater and end it all. Now, The Lottery is, by definition, an extremely unhappy story, and yet now it is also considered a classic of 20th century literature, notwithstanding that poor woman in the bathtub. So we must find something in these stories that have dark, sad, unhappy places at their core. What is it? What is the point of delving into the lives of unhappy people when all of us have problems of our own? Don't we crave escape from unhappiness and not a deeper path into it? Well, I don't know. It seems to me that unhappy is not, in fact, the worst thing for a book to be. It may not even be the worst thing for a person to be. I mean, of course, unhappiness is awful, and I would never mean to downplay the very real cost of some of the terrible things that I've written about. But maybe unhappiness is also important in stories and in our lives because it can serve as an engine for change. It can be the key to self-awareness because it compels us to investigate and construct our definition of happiness in the same way that a sick person thinks deeply and longingly about physical health. We tell ourselves stories in order to live, is the way Joan Didion put it, and that means not crafting easy fictions, but making meaning out of the difficult reality of our lives. If we only told happy stories, then those people who are mired in moments of unhappiness will go through life feeling unrecognized and that much more alone. I don't necessarily believe in literature as therapy or as a healing mechanism, but I do believe that stories should be tools of truth. Otherwise, they aren't stories, but pale comforts, and we see through them pretty quickly. In the past few weeks, I've been rereading the work of Alastair MacLeod, and I was struck by a moment in his short story, The Vastness of the Dark, also about a letter. In this story, a young man reads letters written to his father from his grandparents. The grandfather begs his father, who is working far away from home in Idaho at the time, to come home and work with him. You can hear his love for his son and his longing to see him again. But the grandmother sends a short, terse letter to her son that says, "Don't listen to him. Don't come home." She wants her son to be happy, and so she tries very brusquely to keep her child away from her, presumably at a cost to herself. It seems harsh for a mother, and yet it's perfectly maternal. All of her love and all of her hope for her son, all of her ideas about happiness and unhappiness are crystallized in that letter that is no more than two or three lines long. It's a very tiny moment, and yet to me it's very moving. All stories, I think, are like that letter, and for that matter, like the letter that I received. Driven by thoughts about unhappiness, they bring us to the how and why of happiness, and they suppose that it does exist and can be found. So to the person who sent that letter stating maybe there are happy things in life and maybe you should write about them someday, I would answer in all honesty that I already am.
Hey, everybody. Hi. I'm Al Ray. I'm a comedian, I expect. I'm originally from Toronto, but I live in Winnipeg. You could say I'm a transplanted Torontonian living in Winnipeg. Transplant was a complete success, although in order to prevent my brain from rejecting Winnipeg, I have to take drugs for the rest of my life. A good crowd. I like it. I like literary events. I like a smart, erudite crowd. I did a show last week in Toronto. I met a couple there,
And he was an entomologist. An entomologist, so he could tell you every species of bug and their particular habits and characteristics. And his wife was an entomologist, an etymologist. And so she could take the names of those bugs, and she could give you their Greek and Latin origins. And they had no friends. I'm a comic, and I'm manic, and I'm depressive. Steve Martin once said, boy, those French, it's like they have a different word for everything. And my favorite French word next to poutine is ennui. Ennui. It's more than being bored with life or the world. It's being bored with how bored you are with life or the world. And it's my favorite state of mind word next to the German word Schadenfreude, which means taking intense pleasure in the misfortunes of others, as opposed to taking intense pleasure in your own misfortune, which is being a Jewish mother. Reminds me of I'm a Scotsman. So this little joke digression is a Scotsman, an Irishman, and a Jewish guy, and they're in a desert, and there's nothing around, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's a tavern, and the Scotsman goes in, and he says, I'm parched, I'm exhausted, I'm dehydrated, he says, I must have a scotch. And the Irish guy says, I'm parched, I'm exhausted, I'm dehydrated, so I must have a Guinness. And the Jewish man says, I'm exhausted, parched, and dehydrated, I must have diabetes. A lot of our mood from our cultures. I first came across the word ennui in the Cole Porter song, I Get a Kick Out of You. When I'm out on a quiet spree, fighting vainly that old ennui. And we know that Cole Porter suffered from manic depression, that lovely oxymoronic phrase, quiet spree. So descriptive of a certain type of mania that I really understand. And he doesn't get solace or a rise in self-esteem out of you, just a kick, a temporary lift in mood. And here's the kicker. He gets a kick, though it's clear to see you obviously do not adore me. So he was a masochist, too. It's very difficult to convey, to carry forward to another place, to another person, our state of mind. When we are in a disordered state of mind, we act disturbed, another old French word. And so if you're like me, you sometimes bring the disorder outside of yourself and you disturb the peace by putting on a big show of your feelings. And we call this emoting. We're emotional. And we performers, we're blessed to have a stage or other venue to emote, to have an outlet, to let out these feelings. And I think that's why my manic episodes are less emotive. They're quieter sprees because I have this outlet. Now, you'll hear some say that the words emotion and feeling are interchangeable, but you can tell in a culture who has an outlet to let out their feelings and who doesn't by how emotional they're permitted to get. Women and children have no outlet. Their feelings are ignored. Women don't like war. And the reason is because they don't like feeling grief when they see children dying. But we don't talk about their feelings because generals have feelings too about the justness and the necessity of these necessary justifications. So we're told women don't hate war because they have very understandable negative feelings about it, but because they are too emotional, or often they are too, that word from the uterus, hysterical. And you'll notice our enemies are always hysterical and emotional. And yet at the same time, paradoxically, they're seen as cold-blooded and reptilian. And that's a kind of dual state of mind that's impossible. They're not that way, our enemies. We declare them that way. Why? Because we overstate their emotions and deny their feelings. And manic depressives like me deny our feelings, or at some stage have had our feelings denied. So we're all about emoting to show you our state of mind, and we're shitty actors because we're not sure what a lot of the lines we're trying to convey in the script. A script we wrote ourselves, by the way, actually means to us at any given moment. We're bad at understanding our own subtext. So we're too up or we're too down. We're bad actors fighting vainly the old ennui and looking for that next kick. Distracted, good middle English, drawn apart. That's depression. Delirium, literally abandoning the plow or leaving the furrow, or instead of furrowing, describing a crooked and wonky path. That's mania. And Cole Porter was a masochist too, because he got a kick out of his lovebird who did not return the feeling. The masochist said, "Beat me." And the sadist said, "No." And stand-up comics like me are masochists because our kick, that attention from you, doesn't come as a comedian at the end of the play or the end of the book or the end of the song. We want continued vocal approval and laughter every 20, every 30 seconds. Stand-up comedy is the crack cocaine of performing. Instant, instant, instant. And then we go to the bar. We drink. My drinking got so bad at one point my liver considered suing me for divorce. But we decided to stick together for the sake of the kidneys. See, it's clever because it's a book fair. And then we go to the bar, we go to the party, or we take to the internet with our mania, where the show goes on 24/7 through unending status update, status update. I'll give you one solid piece of advice to take with you today. The only thing you ever need to type into a status update, three words, still a narcissist. But enough about me, he joked. I don't know if I gave you any insight into my state of mind, but I hope you don't think I'm too crazy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Al. We do think you're a little crazy, but we love you anyway. I want to thank George, Lisa, Joseph, Alex, Al, Sheila, Madeline, Zoe. Thank you all for sharing all of that with us today. It was absolutely fantastic, widely varying, and wonderful. Thank you again to everyone at the McCord for having us, and to Blue Metropolis for squeezing us into your jam-packed, wonderful festival. Thank you, Cameron Charlebois, and everybody who works with you to make Blue Met happen. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Enbridge in their absence. And I do hope you will all stay with us to have a drink. I know Al will. And join us in some conversation. Two quick things. We Walrus Talks Human Rights in Toronto, May 7th. If you're there, please let me know. And later on in May, the Walrus Talks Water in Vancouver and Toronto. Hope to see you soon. Thank you.